Yes, we can. I'd been involved with flotillas before. In fact, I was on the first boat that broke the siege of Gaza successfully, and that was back in 2008. And there were two boats of 30-odd different nationalities. And we did get into a situation where we were pretty close to Gaza, and suddenly three Israeli gunboats appeared from nowhere and surrounded us. And our communications went down, our mobiles went down, just everything, the power in the ships, even the lights, everything just went. And we were, it was pitch black, and we were sitting there waiting, wondering, you know, what's going to happen? Are they going to shell us? What are they going to do? So it was quite tense at the time. And then for some reason, which I still don't know to this day, the Israelis decided to go, and they left. And we had prepared for being boarded. We had prepared to, not resist them, be compliant, and hold our hands up. And so we'd gone through all the training with each other, and as I say, we prepared for all eventualities. And the one thing that we hadn't prepared for was that we wouldn't have any resistance. So we were, the two boats were out in the ocean, and the first boat, the Free Gaza, just started to head off, and we said, you know, through the radios, which came back on, where are you going? And they said, well, we're going to Gaza. And our boats, the Dignity, said, no, it's too soon. We need to generate more publicity. And so we had this bizarre situation where it was, well, what do we do now that we don't have the Israelis stopping us? And, you know, so in the end, the main organizer on our boat, for fear of being thrown overboard, decided to agree with the rest of us and follow the other boat. And we got into the harbor in Gaza, and it's a tiny little harbor, and there were over 100,000 Palestinians there. And the reason why they had come along is that they just didn't expect to see us. It shows how long the siege has gone on for, because it was more than 40 years since anyone had seen a boat arrive in their port. So they'd all turned up, and then I saw this great big poster, and it had all the pictures of the 42 crew up on this big poster. And I'm looking at it, and it was all in Arabic writing, and I was told they really didn't expect you to make it. All of those are for martyrs. And so this is, they had that up as their reserve, but they didn't expect us to get through either. So we got in. The reception was fabulous. I was presented with a Palestinian passport by the late Ismail Haniyeh. And it was, it was a great achievement. We didn't realize how great it was until we actually met the Palestinians, who then told us, especially the fishing people, their community, and all the hardships that they go through when they go to fish. So it really was quite an amazing event. And the president of the UN said at the time that what we had done was in the spirit of Gandhi. You know, it was really, he said some wonderful things. Of course, there was nothing from Gordon Brown, who was the prime minister at the time and had died in the wool Zionist. There was no praise or anything for us. And so we had, as I say, a wonderful time. The next year, we broke the siege by land by driving right across North Africa with George Galloway's Viva Palestina convoy. So this time, when I heard about the flotilla, I said to my husband, who's an Algerian, and Algerians are like Geordies. You know, we've got two moods, happy and psycho, and no in between. And so I said to him, I said, there's a flotilla going out. And he went, no. I said, no, what? He said, you're not going. I said, you know, how, why? And he said, you've done it once before, and I'm scared for you. And I said, but times are different now. And, you know, we've got this genocide, and I'm feeling so helpless. And I know, you know, we've been on the marches in Newcastle and Glasgow, and, you know, we've all done our bit. But you just feel as though I need to do more, and I want to do more. And I said, what's your fear? And he said, well, he said, you could be killed, or even worse, you could be captured by the Israelis. So we discussed it at length, and in the end, he relented, which was great. And the thing is, I wouldn't be able to do half the things that I do without the support of my husband. And I would think that that would be the same for everyone on the flotilla. You know, I would like to bet if somebody came in now and said, right, there's a boat down at the Tyne, who's coming? We're going off to Gaza. You would probably all say yes. If there wasn't something or somebody or a dog or something, at home. So in the end, that wasn't the issue. But he thought that being captured by the Israelis would be far worse than anything. And I have to say, I've been in scrapes before, and we've got no control over whether we live or die. And so, you know, that wasn't an issue that bothered me. We've seen images on our phones, so we know what we're going into. But I really did not want to be captured by the Israelis, because we've seen and heard so many things about them, how they treat the Palestinians in prison, and, you know, how they would treat us. And I know that I get away with a lot through my so-called white privilege, but that was a nagging fear in the back of my mind. The boat I went on was from Libya. And we joined the Samud flotilla. We had a crew of, there was about 17 of us on the boat, three women, and the rest were men, who happily were all brilliant cooks. So I had some fabulous Libyan cuisine. Nobody left the toilet seat up, which was great. there was a wonderful spirit on board our boat. had a really diverse set of people. We had a couple of communists, some left wing. We had a former prime minister on the boat. And we had one man who had, at one time was the most wanted man in Libya. And his poster was everywhere. And he was wanted under the Gaddafi regime. And we discovered this because we needed security to check our cargo, that our aid was aid, that there were no hidden weapons or guns, which is what the Israelis would try and accuse us of. And the head of security saw Libya's most wanted man walking past him, and he went, "Where have you been?" And they had a good laugh because obviously he was no longer wanted. And it was quite funny having this Scarlet Pimpernel with all his colourful stories on board the boat as well. So we had a great mix of people. The Foreign Office told us that Libya wasn't safe. It's on the cusp permanently of a civil war. But the one thing that united Libyans, and we travelled the length and breadth of Libya to raise funds for aid for the boat, everybody was united in one for the people of Palestine. And that was a wonderful feeling. And we were made welcome wherever we went, and we didn't feel as though we were in any danger. So we sailed off and joined the rest of the Samud flotilla. We'd also done our training as well on how we would react in the event that we were boarded, and we had a couple of emergency tryouts on the boat. And we went off, and as we heard from other flotilla members, some had already been attacked by obviously by the Israelis with drone strikes, fire strikes on their ships, and really quite scary stuff. And at one point, there was a drone with really loud speakers that was playing ABBA music at full blast. So these were all tactics that they used to try and deter people from sailing. We got a Mayday alert from one of the largest ships. You'll probably remember which one it was, that was boarded.
Alma, I think.
The Alma, that was boarded by the Israelis. And because we were about the second or the third largest boat, we knew that we would be next. And so we went on the top deck, and sure enough, the drones came over. And we were a bit confused. Somebody said, "The drones that have green lights are the ones that are carrying weapons. The drones that have red lights aren't." Or is it the other way round? And it's like, well, make up your mind, because we've got drones of all colours in front of us. And then they came with on their Zodiac boats with machine guns mounted, and they circled us about three or four times with the express purpose of rocking the boat. The Omar Al Mokhtar was quite a big boat, and they then used a loud hailer and said, "You have two choices: you turn back and go back to Tripoli, or you stay here until the morning and we will escort you to Israel. So off they went again, and we had an emergency meeting with the crew. And I said, well, they've given us two choices, but there's a third choice. And they said, what's that? I said, we can make a run for it. And, you know, we're 2 hours away now from Gaza. And, you know, maybe if we sit here for a while and then in the dead of night sneak away and make a go for it. And 16 out of 17 said yes. And once the majority had said yes, even the one who was hesitant came on board as well. And so we were all united. And, you know, we decided that let's, you know, go for it, hell or bust. And so, of course, there were other people who'd had similar conversations on the flotilla. So there was quite a few of us decided to make a run for Gaza. And as we did, the Israelis obviously preempted this, and they boarded various boats, and then they came to ours. And this IDF soldier stepped on board, and we were all like that, not in surrender, but just to show them we're not carrying any weapons, we're not posing a threat to you, we're not, you know, a danger to you. And as the spokesperson for the boat, I went up to him and introduced myself, and I said, I want you to know that we are in international waters, and what you are doing is illegal. It's an act of piracy, and it's tantamount to kidnap. Do you understand? And he nodded. And I said, no, I really need to know that you understand what I'm saying, because it's important that when you board this boat, you and all your fellow soldiers know that what you are doing is illegal. In fact, it's a war crime. And he said, yes, we understand. And I said, good, because when I give evidence in The Hague and you're standing in the dock, I can say that I explained to you that what you were doing was illegal. And I said, and we know through Nuremberg that simply obeying orders doesn't cut it. And he nodded again, and they came on board. I have to say they were unbearably well-mannered. They kept offering sandwiches and water. None of us would accept anything from them, and said, give them to the people in Gaza. They're the ones who are starving. And then the men were put down in the hold, in the cargo, with the aid. And the three women, we were escorted back to our cabin. And one of these soldiers sat outside with a machine gun, just sitting there looking pretty bored. He wasn't hyped up or anything. And then he changed, and another one sat down. And the one who sat down was the one who had first boarded the boat that I'd spoken to. And one of the instructions that we were given is, don't look them in the eye, don't engage with them, don't, you know. And I'm sitting looking, and I thought, I can't keep quiet any longer. And I said, tell me, I said, what is it like working for the most hated army in the world? And he said, you can say what you want, I don't care. He said, we've heard it all before, and we don't care. We know everybody hates us. And I'm thinking, he's sounding like a Millwall supporter here. You know, we don't care. Even our friends don't like us, and we don't care. So say whatever you want to say, and it doesn't matter to us. We are on our own, and that is the way we prefer it. And that was the mentality of this soldier, which was obviously shared by all of his colleagues. What was interesting is that although they were unbearably nice, inasmuch as they weren't shouting or abusing anyone, most of the soldiers had masks on, and that is, I think, because of these the work being done to bring them to account for war crimes. They didn't want to be recognised, and so it obviously is having an impact, which was reassuring. You know, they might not care, but they didn't want to be recognised. So a few hours later, we ended up in Ashdod Port, which should have been really busy, but it wasn't. It was dead. And of course, I remembered hearing on the news that the Italian dock workers said, lay one finger on that flotilla and we will bring everything to a halt. And they certainly had at Ashdod, because nothing was sailing in or out. The only movement was coming from flotilla boats. So we were tied up next to the Alma and waited for a couple of hours. There was lots of activity in this great big, it looked like an aircraft hangar. Lots of people in uniforms, different uniforms, but all Israelis moving backwards and forwards. And the moment I stepped on to the quayside, the atmosphere changed completely. This Israeli woman, again an IDF soldier, she said, take that off. And she was referring to my keffiyeh, which I had on as a turban. And I said, no. I said, this is my hijab. I'm a Muslim, and this is part of me and part of who I am. She said, get rid of it now. And I said, no. And if you don't like it, you take it off. I said, there are all these people who can witness you taking, and I, as I'm talking like that, there was this huge slap on the back of my head, my arm went up my back, and an IDF soldier just frog marched me away from the quayside. He then pulled my hijab off and threw it down with contempt, and as he frog marched me towards this holding pen where there were about 100 people sitting cross-legged, on the concrete, and he told me to go and sit down, and I did. And then 5 minutes later, somebody returned shouting for Yvonne Annie. That's they never used Ridley. It was just Yvonne Annie, and I said yeah, and said this way. So I went with them into this big holding area. And it was, there were tables at various stages, and there was a crocodile of people moving in and out of these tables. It was a bit like an airport queue, and one was for taking, emptying suitcases, another was fingerprints, another was giving your details, and it was vast, as I say, like an airport hangar. And I'd got about five or six steps in, and this female soldier came up to me and she said, take that off. And I'm looking and she's pointing at my skirt. And it was a tartan skirt. It was a maxi down to the ground. And she said, take it off. And I said, what, here, now? And she went, yes. And I sort of leant forward, hoping for a bit of a girly chat. And I said, I'm not wearing anything underneath. She said, take it off. So I said, I can't, not in front of all of these people. And she said, if you don't take it off, these two will help you, pointing at the Israeli soldiers. And I'm just thinking, gosh, my husband, he'll be having a fit at all of this. So I just pulled the, I mean, I was wearing panties, but so I just pulled the skirt down and kicked it over to her. And I said, there, are you satisfied now? And this more senior officer shouted over. I don't know what he was saying. They all shouted. They never talked. And he shouted over at her. And she turned round to me and screamed at me, put it back on now. So I put the skirt back on. And then she got hold of my arm and marched me into a changing room area. And she took me into the changing room and she said, take it off. And I said, what? She said that, pointing to my skirt again. I said, what is this? You know, what's going on here? I said, do you fancy me or something? You know, what is this? And I said, do you want to look at my legs again? And she just turned around and went storming off. And then another one came in and she took me by the arm and took me back out and took me to a table area, and she told me to put my backpack on the table, and that I had my handbag with me. And this man came along and he just tipped the handbag upside down and emptied it, and just everything scattered. And he picked up a lipstick. You know, I'd bought this lipstick in Phoenix. It was quite precious to me. And he picked the lipstick up, looked at it, threw it in a bin. And I went, that was Chanel. And he just went, what? And I said, you know, just... And then he picked up my driving license in the bin, picked up my credit cards in the bin, picked up my hearing aids, and he's about to throw them. And I said, hold on, I said, they're my hearing aids. I need them. And I said, otherwise I can't hear anything. And he looked at them and took the batteries out, threw the batteries in the bin and gave me the hearing aids back. And I, you know, really felt like shouting deaf, deaf to the IDF. I was, but I thought, no, just... And then this girl started going through my jackets, through the linings, through the hems, through every... And I remembered reading about this Jewish woman who'd gone through a processing center in Belsen. And she said a lot of the Jewish women hid their precious items and valuables and stitched them inside, jackets and coats and everything. And I'm looking and I'm thinking, my God, you know, these are the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of the Holocaust, and they're acting like Nazis. And it was really sobering just watching this. And then she pulled out a grey T-shirt and I thought, oh no. It was inside out, deliberately so. And she went like, why is this inside out? And she pulled it out, looked at it, turned it round and thrust it in my face. And there was a picture of Leila Harlot, the Palestinian hijacker, looking really mean and moody with her Kalashnikov. And underneath was a woman's place is in the resistance. So she's saying, you know, what's this? And I just went like that. And suddenly this soldier pushed past me, pulled out a knife and started stabbing at this picture of Leila Harlad. And he just, it was like a scene from Psycho, but without the shower. And he's going like this. And he carried on until beads of sweat were coming down his face. And you, well, the shirt was just shredded. And when he'd finally finished, he looked at me triumphantly. And I said, all these years, and she still scares you. And he looked and thankfully put his knife away and he went off. But you know, I was starting to feel a bit more confident at this point, because they all looked fearful. They weren't happy. I think that meeting so many white Europeans, looking at them as though they'd found something nasty on the bottom of their shoe, I think that it really did get to them, and maybe they did care. Then I was taken to the next station. Oh, sorry, before that, they took my pills and medicines, and they went in the bin as well. But they did this with the asthma sufferers. They took their inhalers, threw them in the bin. Their nebulizers, people who needed medicine to keep them alive, in the bin. The heart pills, kidney pills, you know, really vital medicines, just went in the bin. And they were, as I say, they were really, they weren't happy at all. You know, they looked thoroughly miserable, but there was this fear, and I could almost feel it, that they had. And as I moved away and went to another station, I heard one of the leaders of the Summit Flotilla, a girl called Yasmin. She's got a very distinctive voice, and I heard her shouting. And I looked over at her and then followed the line of sight. And there was Ben Gavir swaggering in. You're all terrorists. You're all going to prison for a long time. You're going to prison for 18 years, 20 years. You're all terrorists. And you know, they're just swaggering around. And I had what I can only describe as a meltdown. The red mist descended. And I went, not from happy, but I was up there psycho, and I went running towards him, shouting, from the river to the sea. And as I took the next breath to say, Palestine will be free, 5 IDF soldiers jumped on me. One tried to throttle me, another one put his hand over my mouth, and another one pegged my nose, just to shut me up. And while this was happening, it was like a voice in my head was saying, what the hell are you doing? You're a peace activist. So I don't know whether I should be thankful that the 5 stopped me, because frankly, I don't know what I would have done had I actually managed to reach him. Well, I can see what I would have, you know, probably tried to throttle him, but it was really beyond my control. And when I look back, I think, you know, if I'd been Palestinian, I would have been shot in the back, without a doubt. And so it must have really pained them to be, not treat us with kid gloves, but certainly treat us a few degrees better than the way they treated the Palestinians. After that, I was put in handcuffs where everybody else was put in those plastic hand ties. And I was told to stand against a wall and just face the wall. I'm standing there, and then I was taken to another station where they asked me to sign a piece of paper that was all in Hebrew. And I said, well, what does it say? And it says you've entered Israel illegally. I said, I didn't enter Israel illegally. I said, I was kidnapped and taken hostage. And they slammed the table as soon as I mentioned the word hostage and said, if you don't sign, you'll get 8 years. And I said, well, I'm not signing. So I was again moved on, and there was little Greta Thunberg. You know, she's a diminutive figure, and I didn't know it until later, but she had been grabbed by a load of IDF soldiers who dragged her and made her kiss an Israeli flag, you know, and but she, you know, she looked as though she was handling everything very well and with a quiet dignity. Then I noticed that there were a few computers around, and I thought, gosh, I hope that they're not looking at my Twitter account. But what was interesting, these computers, they weren't hooked up to the internet. They were to take fingerprints and to... they were internal computers. And I thought, no, they don't want anything that would have a permanent record. Most of the work that they did, you know, who are you, what's your name, they would put down on paper. And it was as though they just didn't want a computer record of what they were doing, which I thought was quite interesting. The other thing as well, nobody seemed to be in charge. You know, when there's military around, if somebody with pips on their shoulders comes by, people are going like that, yes sir, no sir. There was none of that. And as I say, not one person seemed to be directing or in charge. Then I was taken into another room, and this man was sitting there with scissors, and he told me to put my foot on a little platform, so I did. And I watched, and he just cut through my shoelaces and on my Puma shoes. I was furious, and I said, what the hell do you think you're doing? And he said, other foot, and did the same. And so I'm sort of barely walking around, you know, in these sports shoes, and they did that to everybody. I was because I'd been so naughty earlier on with Ben-Gavir, I was fast-tracked through this whole procedure, and then they put me into the one of the prison vans and into one of those little cubicles, and they ramped up the air conditioning, and they left me there for 2 hours. I was absolutely freezing. And, you know, it was just totally unnecessary. But anything they could do to make life unpleasant for anyone, they would do. So I was there for about 2 hours, and eventually the bus filled up. And then we drove off, and the driver kept slamming on the brakes so that we were thrown around in the bus. Really petty little things that they did. But perhaps the most sinister thing that happened from there was in Kitsiot Prison, which is in the Negev Desert. It's sandwiched between Beersheba and the Dimona nuclear plant, and which is about 20 miles away. And I went into this sort of porter cabin room, and it was pitch black outside, very much as it is now in Newcastle. And the room was highly illuminated, and there were two windows that were both wide open, that you couldn't see anything, it was just pitch black. And one of the women said, take your top off. And I said, well, can we have the window shut? And they said, take your top off. I said, there could be anyone out there with a mobile phone, a camera, a video. And I'm sure that I heard something outside. And they said, take your top off or we'll make it happen. And so I took my T-shirt off and I had a sports bra underneath. And she then said, take it off. And I said, oh, you know, it's my bra. I can't. And she wanted me to take it off. And if I wasn't going to take it off, somebody would pull it off. So I just thought, well, if there is anybody out there who's getting off on seeing a 67-year-old taking her kit off, you know, God help them. So I took that off, and they went in a bin, and then they gave me a white T-shirt and a grey fleece jumper, and the skirt came off again and went off into the bin, and they gave me a pair of grey jogging bottoms, and the shoes, my trainers came off, they went in the bin, and they gave me some plastic shoes to slide into, and then I was taken out and put in a cage, followed by Greta Thunberg. So the pair of us were sitting there in silence, you know, there was nothing much that we could say. Then another girl came and she sat next to me, and I said, are you all right? And she said, no. And I said, what have they done? And she'd been internally examined and she was traumatized. She was a very, very pretty Swedish girl, and she was just, I could see, on the verge of tears. And then very soon the whole cage had filled up with various people who had different stories to tell. There was a woman from New Zealand who was distraught because she'd been given an abalone shell from a friend, a close friend in New Zealand. And she said, you know, they just pulled this box out and said, what's in here? And she said, it's a gift from a friend. And the soldier, she opened the box and she saw this shell and she went, oh, she said, that's beautiful. And she pulled it out and she said, yeah, I told you, it's a gift from a friend. And then she said to the Israeli soldier next to her, look at this, have you seen a shell like this? And he looked at it and he said, oh, it's beautiful. And the pair of them were saying how wonderful it was, and then threw it in the bin. And she was really upset at that. Anything that was of any personal value, they really took pleasure in watching you crestfallen as they were destroyed. My daughter's little pictures, you know, that you keep in a purse, everything just went in the bin. So we were then taken out of the cage and assigned different cells, and I was I'd swap places with somebody which would have enabled Greta Thunberg to be with somebody who she knew and who would be looking after her. So I ended up in a cell with most of the women were Spanish and were from South America, and they were just a fantastic group of women. And people say to me, you know, what was it like? And I said, in some of it, it was the best of times. And in other parts, it was the worst of times, you know, without sounding like Charles Dickens. It really, being with these women was so inspiring. And I learned Bella Chow in Spanish, and we were quite, there were 17 of us in the cell with one toilet. Most of us were on hunger strike. And those of us who weren't, poor souls, had to eat this this food, which was riddled with ants and really inedible anyway. And so we were all in this cell. About 2 o'clock every morning, without any warning, the cell door would burst open and half a dozen men with machine guns would come charging in, pointing them in all directions, and then an older one would come in and start counting. And he started counting 1, 2, 3, 4, and as soon as he got to 4, we shouted back, "Occupation no more." So after that, he started counting in Arabic. So we, you know, we never missed an opportunity to remind them who we were and why we were there. The Italian group, they were amazing. They were allowed out in the exercise yard once, and during that time they threw their slippers at the Israeli flag, dislodging one corner, this giant Israeli flag up on the, and these soldiers were mortified at this behavior. Our cell had, you know, we were particularly raucous, and so we never got any exercise. We weren't allowed any lawyers, despite asking constantly for lawyers, for doctors. We weren't given any. And then one day, about 12 o'clock at night, it was before the guys had come in for the count, it was Yvonne Annie to the door. So I went, and they said, "You're going to court." And I thought, 12 o'clock at night. So I was taken into this courtroom, and there was a judge sitting there, and he said, "Why did you come here?" So I told him, "Well, there's a genocide unfolding, and we wanted to put food on the table for babies, you know, bring them formula milk." And he said, "So if we let you go to Gaza, what will you do?" I said, "Oh, please." I said, "That would be wonderful." I said, "I'll take the aid from our boat and I'll be able to distribute it." I said, "We've got some highly nutritious packs for the children." And he said, "Where will you stay?" I said, "Well, where can I stay?" I said, "You've bombed all of the homes. You've bombed the hotels. You've bombed the schools. You've bombed the universities." I said, "I'm not staying in Gaza. I'll just deliver my aid and then I'll go." And he screamed at me, "Get out!" So I walked, sat, you know, jumped up and just went out. And I still don't know what the court case was about. I wasn't charged with anything. I wasn't asked to plead for anything. it was just a bizarre encounter. Again, no one seemed to be in charge, and I went out, and there were a lot of people standing around, and in uniform, and they were just sort of looking at me, and I said, "Who's in charge here?" And they were just sort of looking round, and they really didn't know what to do. And I was taken back into my cell. Now then, I understand when I was released that there'd been a bit of a scare had gone on to say that I had gone missing. And what happened that day, I think it was 2 days into my stay, the flap came down on the cell door and it was, "Yvonne, Annie, to the door." And I got up and it was, Yella, "You're going home." And all the girls were cheering, and I went, "Oh, wow," you know. And so I said goodbye to all of the girls, you know, individually. I bonded with all of them. They were amazing. And this guy is screaming at me all the time, Yella. And then he opened the door and went right into my face, "Yella, you're going home." And I looked at him, I said, "I wish you were going home." And he looked and he just slammed the door shut and off he went. And he didn't tell anyone what he'd done. And this is the thing with the Israelis. If no one's in charge, no one can be accountable. So meanwhile, back at the bus, when people are getting on, Margaret, who was one of my cabin mates, she said, "Where's Yvonne? I'm not going home without Yvonne." And she's quite loud and she's from Glasgow and, you know, she's feisty. And they said, "Oh, she's coming in the next bus, just get on." And so she got to Amman Airport, got out, waited for the next bus, and when the doors opened, she said, "Where's Yvonne?" And people said, "Don't know, she's not got on the bus." So she immediately went off to the media and said, "Yvonne Ridley's gone missing. She was last seen leaving the prison," and so this rumour just swept the place. But that guy was back in his job the next day. He just hadn't told anybody, and they just don't seem to be keeping records. You know, everything was on paper. There was no computers or anything like that. So I just thought, well, me and my big mouth, so I'm going to be here for a little bit longer. And then we started hearing stories coming from cell to cell, and just talking to people through the bars about what was happening. And we were told that one of the girls in two cells down was Jewish, and she was making her mouth go at the Israeli guards, and she was told, "If you don't shut up, we're going to gas you." And they threatened to fire tear gas into her cell. Another woman from South Africa, the South Africans were really treated badly because of the ICC court and all of that. One of the South African women, a doctor, she was a breast cancer survivor. She'd had a double mastectomy. And when she went into the showers, the girls, the female prison officers, made fun of her and were shouting at the men, their colleagues, saying, "Oh, we've got this woman in here. She has no breasts." And they mocked her. And I just thought about this and I'm thinking, I don't know anywhere in the world where one woman would mock another woman who's a cancer survivor. I just, you know, especially breast cancer, and yet there was absolutely no sisterhood at all. In fact, what I found quite alarming was just talking to the other women prisoners. We'd all been told to remove our bras, and those of us who were allowed out to exercise were sort of walking round trying to hold ourselves in, and we believe that the women were doing this to deliver braless women to their male colleagues who were sitting around and, you know, would just look you up and down, and it was awful. And there was one incident where I had been out to see the British consular official, which was a waste of time, and I came back and I saw Sarah Wilkinson, who she's a well-known Palestinian activist, and Sarah was really quite dizzy and disorientated, and she was going through the first stages of hydration, you know, of dehydration. And this soldier walked past with a full bottle of water, and I said, oh, I said, give me your water. And he said, it's mine. And I said, get over yourself. I said, this woman needs some water. He said, no, this water is mine. And, you know, I threw a few insults at him, and he would not part with this water. And I said, this woman is old enough to be your mother. And I said, she desperately needs water. Just give me the bottle. And he refused, so I started shouting, you know, is there water anywhere? There's a woman in danger of collapse here. And they were just milling around. Nobody came running. Nobody. It was unbelievable. But again, nobody was in charge. And it was. So I went up to this man who'd been holding his bottle of water as though it was gold. And I said, I will remember your face. I said, and I will give evidence against you. I said, this is a war crime. You are standing there with a full bottle of water that you don't need, and she desperately does. And I went right in up to his face, almost nose to nose, and I said, I will remember your face. And then he came back to me and said, and I will remember you and your face. And the way he looked at me, I just, for the first time, I started to feel really afraid. And I remember going back to the cell and saying to the girls, look, as we're all coming and going, please don't leave me on my own in this cell. And, you know, watch out for that guy. He's a really nasty piece of work. After that, you know, we kept hearing these different stories. We were the last ones to go, apart from a group of Spanish girls, and one of them had bitten one of the female prison officers. There'd been a bit of argy-bargy in one of the cells, and during this melee, one of the Spanish girls bit. We nicknamed the prison officers the Chihuahuas because they were all much younger and yappy, very yappy. And it sort of went round, you know, oh, somebody's bitten one of the Chihuahuas. And the next day, this soldier who had a taser, a handgun, that Kevlar armour, you know, he looked like RoboCop, and his machine gun. And he said to the sort of leader in our cell, you know, we're really vulnerable here. One of our prison officers has just been assaulted. We just don't feel safe at all. And it's like, what, you know. So then we were told that we could have a shower, and everybody was really excited, apart from me. And I just said, hang on. You know, look what the Nazis did to the Jewish people when they said, come on, you can have a shower. And they said, yeah, but they wouldn't do anything to us, would they? I said, I don't know. I really don't know. But I said, I'm taking the cubicle next to the door. And we had a shower. It was cold. But, you know, when you haven't washed for nearly a week, it was welcome. And so we went back and into our cell, which did smell quite rancid. And then it was, Yala, you're all going home. This time I thought, keep your mouth shut, Yvonne. And we were taken out and put on a bus, and driven out of Kitsiat prison. And when we got to sort of nearly to no man's land, you know, we were letting rip with Bella Chow and Free Free Palestine and all the songs, and the Jordanian ambassador got on our bus and he said, please, this is a very tense day. It was October the 7th. This is a very tense day. Please, we're on a knife edge. Just simmer down and wait until you get into Jordan. And we looked, and the anger and hatred on the faces of all those who were there to guard us, to make sure that we went off safely. It was, you know, really, really, the hatred was palpable. And so we got to the, into Jordan, and we were told, right, you're now in Jordan. And I just had a big sigh, and I just started sobbing uncontrollably. I don't know, I didn't realize that there was that much emotion inside me, and one of the girls hugged me, and we just cried together that this horrible ordeal was finally over. And we got into the airport, and I'm looking round. All the ambassadors or embassies were represented with flags, so I'm looking round for the butcher's apron. And I couldn't see it, but then I spotted one of the consular officials who I'd met earlier, and she said, "Right, we're going to put you in a hotel tonight. Then we're going to fly you to Istanbul, and then we'll work out the logistics and the costings, and we'll get you off back to the UK. And I said, what costings? She said, well, somebody has to pay. I said, well, it better not be me. I said, I was kidnapped and taken hostage. I said, I'm not paying to leave Israel. I said, they can pay. And she said, well, it doesn't quite work like that. And this guy next to me, he's going crazy saying, I'm not paying a penny. You know, they brought us here. They can take us back. And one of my shipmates from the Omar al-Mokhtar heard this. And the next thing I know, the Libyan ambassador came over to me and he said, Yvonne, we would be greatly honoured if you would come back with us to Libya, and we will make sure that you get back to the UK. We'll fly you into Istanbul, and the president has said that he will send his private jet to pick you all up and take you back. There's a big crowd waiting for you. And I said, I'm with you guys. So I said, let me just inform the Brits. So I went back and said to the consular official, I said, I don't want you to take this personally, but I'm not coming back with you. She said, well, how will you get back to England? And I said, I'm going with the Libyans. I said, in fact, they're putting on a private jet and taking us to a big reception, and the president wants to see us. And she looked and she said, well, Libya isn't safe. I said, excuse me. I said, I've seen pictures of people in wheelchairs in London being dragged into police stations. And we later found out that Sarah Wilkinson had been stopped and arrested at Heathrow or Gatwick and charged with 3 terror offences. I said, I don't think I'm safe going back to Britain anyway. I said, I'll be a lot safer with these guys. She said, well, as long as I know. And I said, well, let's face it. I said, Keir Starmer isn't going to put on a private jet for me, is he? And she looked and went. So off we went. The Libyans treated us so wonderfully. And we got the private jet, and when we landed there were hundreds waiting for us. And it was then that we began to realise that the flotilla was much bigger than we thought it had been. And I know that our captain, he felt particularly pained because we didn't get to deliver the aid. And he was saying, you know, we failed. And I said, we didn't fail. I said, this was a long journey with various stages, and we had little victories all along the way. And I said, we didn't fail. But he began to realise what I meant when he saw all the people there who were waiting for us, who were... are you telling me to...
Yeah. I'm engrossed, but I know we've been going on quite a...
No, it's all right. It was wonderful. And we were taken to Tunisia, and we flew back on a Jet 2 flight, and all the holiday makers, Red Lobsters, and standing there bemused as they were held back while we walked through the Tunisian airport to loud applause and acclaim. And it was really wonderful. Then we landed in Manchester, and the police were there waiting for us and tried to push us out through a side door. But we heard that there were people in the airport waiting to see us, so we went and we had a welcome reception there. It was great. Would I do it again? Yes, I would. And I'm hoping that my sister here, who I haven't seen her since... across the bows the boat, of two boats. I'm waiting to... you'll be able to find out how you can go on the next flotilla. And I don't want anybody to say, oh, I'm too old. Like Tony, I'm a pensioner. And like Tony, I've got a false hip. And all sorts of other problems associated when you hit your 60s. If I can do it, anybody can. And so thank you for being so attentive, and I'm sorry, Chair, for rambling on.